This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
When was the last time I took a road trip? How many national parks could I hit in 2 weeks? What about hotels? Wait, hey, Erica, how much am I spending on travel?
When your questions about life turn into questions about money, there's Erica, the virtual financial assistant to help you spend, save, and plan smarter. Only from Bank of America. What would you like the power to do? Erica is only available in the English language. You must download the latest version of the mobile banking app, only available on select mobile devices. Your chat may be recorded and monitored for quality assurance. Message and data rates and additional terms may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello and welcome to The Rest Is Money with me, Steph McGovern.
And with me, Robert Peston. What have you been up to?
I was actually, I was in the BBC yesterday, and it's that thing of, obviously, you and I worked together there for a long time. And then I was waiting in reception and went through to where like the news area bit is. I was doing a show for Radio 4. But it's amazing how many people are still in the same seats that they were in when we were there years ago. I was looking down at the newsroom and I was like...
And they haven't even changed chair.
No.
Have they been home since we left?
I don't know. I'm sure they have, but it's really fascinating. I was like, wow, there's, so-and-so off the 6 and 10 o'clock news. And wow, I was just thinking it's really funny how there's not necessarily the bigger turnover as you might think there.
But it is one of those institutions, which I think is a good thing in general. Yeah. I mean, I think institutions which manage to retain people, It's a good sign.
It was funny though being there, because I think I should just once a week go and stand in the BBC reception, because it starts loads of rumours about why I'm there. So like loads of people from different departments were like, Steph McGovern's in reception, why is she here? And I'm like,
are you the new DG, Steph?
Yeah.
Are you the new
just DG? Just going to talk about a few contracts. I was actually there recording a radio show,
but it is odd, isn't it? I don't know. I always feel slightly odd when I go back. You sort of think whenever you go back to an institution you've been through for years, it's almost as when you go back in the door, it's that sort of really odd feeling of maybe I've never left. Have the years since then, is it like a dream? Is it like that edition of Dallas? Yeah. So I've just woken up and actually all those years of being at ITV, it's very odd that, isn't it?
It is, especially because I'm working with you again. I really have got that nostalgia thing going on, the deja vu.
We love that.
Yes, right. Shall we talk about what's in the show? So we are going to talk about Vodafone.
Which is also a trip down memory lane.
Because
I mean, my goodness, what a long-running saga that is.
Yes, and I am really interested as well about talking about Neuralink, which is this kind of sci-fi business that Elon Musk has, which is all about implants in the brain to help people use computers with just using their brains to think, for the whole talk around it is it's for people who are paralyzed. There's a lot of interesting business stuff going on in the background with it too. But we're going to kick off with Vodafone. In terms of news, Vodafone is currently trying to merge with Three. This is a deal that's worth something like £16 billion. And it would reduce the number of operators in the UK from 4 to 3. So understandably, the competition regulator is worried about this and they're looking into it. They're doing an investigation, aren't they? Because they're obviously worried about whether it could lead to less choice, higher prices. Whereas Vodafone's argument is this is all about them wanting to scale to invest, which they say will be good. But there's a lot to unpick here about Vodafone, isn't there?
There is. And I read the Competition and Markets Authority's preliminary judgment on all of this, and it raises two main concerns. One is that if you shrink the number of network operators from 4 to three, then over time, there is a greater risk. This is not how they express it, but you know, this is the way for people to understand it. There's just a greater risk that we'll be ripped off, that there'll be less of the kind of competition we need to see prices set at a level that isn't a rip-off, and indeed that we won't see innovation being undermined, because basically, you know, it'll be the equivalent, this is the extreme version of it, they don't put it quite like this, but essentially, you know, they'll effectively be a cartel of three and they'll stitch us up. So that is one risk. And then the other risk is, as you know, these aren't the only businesses. So the big network operators, just to remind people, are O2, BT, which merged with EE, Vodafone, and Three, which want to merge. But there are also other providers of mobile services. So Tesco, I think there's one, I never know how to pronounce this. Is it Labara, it's called? Anyway, there are a variety of other mobile service providers who have to buy network capacity from the big four network owners. And again, the Competition and Markets Authority says there's a risk if the number of network operators goes from four to three, these providers of services who have to lease capacity will get a worse deal, and that again will be worse for consumers. The likes of Tesco, for example, will have less market power and they will get worse deals, and then we will have worse deals.
Yeah. Although the argument back from Vodafone on that, obviously, because they're trying to prove to the regulator that it's not going to be a problem for consumers, is that by having Three's capacity as well and their customers and everything else, they'll be able to scale up the business, have more economies of scale, and therefore use that money to invest in the infrastructure, which is a big problem. But there's a bit of politics in all of this, isn't there too?
Actually, just before, I thought it was just worth looking at one other aspect though of the competition issue, which is just one of those weird things that sort of bugs me. For as long as anybody can remember, there's been big four banks. Do you remember we always used to talk about the big four banks, right? We always talk about the big four accountants. Do you remember?
And energy companies.
There's always the big four. I don't know whether there's actual really compelling economic analysis around this, but it is true. I sort of, in an intuitive sense, do get a bit nervous when you're back to the big three. People would say the big four banks haven't been competitive enough. There hasn't been enough competition in that market. And certainly in all sorts of other industries, even when you've got four, there are anxieties about whether the competitive tension is what it should be. I think there is a much greater risk of businesses just becoming fat and complacent when there are three. But we have got scared in this country, and I would say if you look at us versus America, this is a mistake. We have got scared of businesses that become dominant, employ lots of people, invest lots. We become scared of what you might call national champions. France has a whole bunch of national champions, you know, the LVMHs and the L'Oreals. And, you know, they are world-class, enormous companies. They're in the top 25 companies. One of the things I've mentioned on this podcast, I think, innumerable times is 24, 25 years ago, the UK had three companies in the world's 25 biggest. Now we have zero companies. And 25 years ago, Vodafone was one of those big top 25 companies. And now it's a tiddler.
But I guess the other side of this is, yes, okay, if you're looking at this from a competition and consumer point of view, to go from four to three suggests that that's going to be bad for the consumer because there'll be less choice and everything else. But if that fourth company is not doing particularly well, but would do better by merging with another and therefore have more money to invest and create more jobs and everything else, surely that's better for the economy.
Yeah, I mean, I think the issue there, though, is that there's no particular evidence that, you know, Vodafone and Three are doing so badly that they're not developing their networks.
They're cutting 11,000 people from their workforce. They've got rid of their businesses in Spain, America, China, France, Japan, New Zealand. They're currently in talks to sell their Italian bit of their business to Swisscom as well. So they're massively downsizing Vodafone, which is never, that's not normally a company that's doing well. That's cutting 10% of its workforce.
I think the important point is all companies make decisions about how they allocate capital. And, you know, Vodafone at the moment is making a whole set of decisions about where it wants to invest. It has made this case that it will, with three, be a more powerful business in the UK. Where we are at the moment is that the Competition and Markets Authority had said, not that they've blocked this deal, but that they've now given a few weeks to three and Vodafone to come back with what's called remedies to sort out the concerns that it's raised. If, I think it's by the middle, so yeah, the end of April, they haven't come back with those remedies, then we'll be into, believe it or not, a six-month investigation of whether this deal is in the public interest.
Takes so long.
It takes forever, because if you remember, it was, you know, in the middle of last year that this was first mooted.
Yeah, it was like June,
wasn't it? So it does go on and on and on. I mean, my own guess would be that if they can't come up with remedies in the next few weeks, then I imagine Three and Vodafone may well just say, okay, we've decided not to press ahead. You mentioned politics a bit earlier on. I was really struck. I was watching the Prime Minister being grilled by the chairs of select committees yesterday. And one of the things that was very striking is that the chair of the Business Select Committee, Liam Byrne, raised this issue of whether there is a national security problem if this deal goes ahead, because Three is owned, controlled by a huge business. It's got something like $50 billion of turnover a year, called CK Hutchison. All its origins are in Hong Kong. It's based in Hong Kong. As it happens, I think it's registered in the Cayman Islands in terms of its so-called legal home. But it's basically a Hong Kong business, which these days means it's a Chinese business. And if you remember all the fuss there was about Huawei and the Chinese government having access to our critical infrastructure and being able to spy on us and take down our infrastructure, and how, you know, basically the British government has told Huawei they cannot get involved anymore at all in our critical infrastructure, and they're over time trying to reduce the presence of Huawei kit in our critical telecoms infrastructure. Liam Byrne says, on that basis, you shouldn't have effectively a Chinese company, you know, owning such an important mobile business here.
I mean, that's very similar to what we were talking about the other day, to do with the America and their concerns about TikTok and the fact that that's Chinese owned. But just looking at how Vodafone has changed, coming back to the specifics of that company, it used to be bigger than Apple, didn't it? So back in 1999, Vodafone's market capitalization, which is how you look at how you kind of value a company, it was $152 billion, and Apple at the time was $16 billion.
So almost 10 times bigger.
Yeah. And obviously today now, Apple's worth, well, it keeps hovering around 3 trillion. It's about just less than that at the minute. Vodafone, 24 billion. The shares are down nearly a third just in this past year alone at Vodafone.
And to put that into context, Vodafone is about the 900th biggest company by market cap in the world. In 2000, you know, it was in the top 25. Mm. The story of Vodafone is, in a way, the story of how much less ambitious British companies have become. I was on the FT in the 90s, and one of the absolutely biggest stories in the corporate world, just one of the biggest stories in Britain, was the incredible ambition of Vodafone, run at the time by this rather plummy-sounding British bloke called Sir Chris Gent. He looked like a character from The Fast Show, you know, wore those sort of slightly sort of boxy black glasses. He spoke with a very public school accent.
I mean, you're describing yourself at the moment.
Okay, I went to a comprehensive in North London. There is about me, and you'll be hearing from my lawyers if you repeat that. Anyway, but he was an incredibly driven chief executive, and he did a whole succession of absolutely mega deals. He bought AirTouch, which was this huge mobile business, I think for about $50 billion at the end of the 90s. He then engaged in and carried out what was at the time by a huge margin, the biggest takeover the world had ever seen when he bought Mannesmann, which was this German mobile phone champion. I think from memory, it was valued at the time, I think the deal was something like $200 billion or something. It was an enormous, it was an absolutely off the charts, enormous takeover. And it caused absolute shockwaves because German national pride was sort of damaged by the idea that this UK stock market, fast growing company, Vodafone, was buying one of their absolute national champions.
In the past, it sounds like Vodafone was at the forefront of mergers and innovation. And I guess what's happened is they haven't moved, as you say. And at the same time, telecom companies have seen their revenues eaten by things like instant messaging service like WhatsApp. So they're not getting that money they were from people sending text messages. The profit margins have shrunk. There's lots of competition issues. There's lots of infrastructure issues. So Vodafone just hasn't kept up with the times, has it?
Vodafone itself has had to restructure multiple times since then under a whole variety of different chief executives. Gent was replaced by Aaron Sarin, who again was in many ways a very impressive chief executive, in turn replaced by an Italian called Vittorio Colao. These are all big personalities. But broadly, the story since Gent was has been one of consolidation and shrinkage, right? It's become a much smaller business. But the other thing, you know, which is really interesting about the Vodafone story, and it's the big difference between then and now. Back then, in the late 90s, early 2000s, you had investors who were prepared to back ambitious British companies with their global expansion ambitions. There was a time when British companies, companies like BP did this in the oil sector as well. We had pharmaceuticals companies doing this. You know, they were backed by investors. They were listed on the stock market. They had high valuations on the stock market. They issued shares on the stock market, which financed these enormously ambitious and important acquisitions overseas. And then sometime, I would say about 15 years ago, all of that goes into reverse. And now if you just look at our critical infrastructure, right, so much of it is owned by overseas investors. You know, our airports are owned by overseas investors. So many of our power companies, energy companies are now foreign owned. When we look to develop all these new sources of power, we were looking to the Chinese. We now have big security concerns about the Chinese, so we're no longer looking to the Chinese to develop our new nuclear stations, but we, you know, we do have the French in EDF building our new nuclear stations. Everywhere you look, every bit of our critical infrastructure is dominated by overseas owners.
It's a shit show. Okay. It's probably time for a break, isn't it?
I think with that, I think synoptic assessment of where we are, I think it's time for a break.
Looking to invest? Start your journey by exploring exchange-traded funds with GlobalX ETFs. Exchange-traded funds, or ETFs for short, create baskets of stocks, bonds, and other assets that you can buy in a single trade. GlobalX specializes in ETFs that track emerging trends, like the rise of artificial intelligence, as well as strategies aimed to generate income potential. Visit GlobalXETFs.com to discover how you can get started.
If you went on a road trip and you didn't stop for a Big Mac or drop a crispy fry between the car seats or use your McDonald's bag as a placemat, then that wasn't a road trip. It was just a really long drive. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Welcome back to The Rest Is Money with me, Robert Peston.
And me, Steph McGovern.
So what are we moving on to?
So we're going to talk now about Elon Musk's business called Neuralink, which it sounds really sci-fi, this business, because it's about implanting a chip in your brain, which can read your thoughts and then help you to do things. And what we've seen this month is him sharing a video of someone who's had this implant put in. And it's a paralyzed patient who lost the use of their arms and legs in a diving accident. And this video shows them being able to play chess on the computer with this, you know, this chip being able to do it. And it's fascinating what's going on in this area, because this was a business, Neuralink, founded, I think it was 2016. And it's all about an implant that connects mind and machine so that people can control computers with their minds. And there's been various points where Elon Musk has been testing this and got in trouble, for example, in how they use animals to test this. So there was this whole thing where it kicked off with an animal rights group who filed a complaint to the authorities in America about the University of California's department called the Davis Primate Center, where they were doing this brain research on using these implants. And they said it was really invasive and deadly on the 23 monkeys who had it. So there's been all that kind of kicking off, but now we're actually seeing it being used in humans. It got clinical approval for humans in May last year, and their first successful implant was in January, and now we've got this video. I mean, it looks like it's going to start with helping people with paralysis, but I guess it's got endless opportunities for the future, and that's where it gets a bit sci-fi. It's worth me probably explaining actually how this chip works, because the chip goes inside the skull and then wireless communications send brain signal data to the Neuralink app, and then the app basically decodes them into actions and, you know, intents. And it's something that can charge wirelessly. And in terms of, you know, getting it put in your brain, it's like a surgical robot that does the implant procedure. But you've got to wonder, haven't you, if the data, if the thoughts are going from someone's brain to this Neuralink app, it could go the other way as well, couldn't it? The Neuralink app could send thoughts to the brain. It could be the supercomputer that controls the brain of the person.
If you want to do the sci-fi nightmare, the artificial intelligence, you know, simply force all of us to have chips in our brains, and then we become the slave robots.
This isn't, though, this kind of technology isn't actually completely new. So it's been around for a while. We've seen in the past electrodes implanted into the brain, which again interprets signals, and it's been used to look at how we might treat Parkinson's or epilepsy, and again paralysis. And it's been demonstrated in the past. I think it was in Utah. There was a something called the Utah Array, which was first demonstrated back in 2004. And there are also important rivals we should talk about in the business world to Elon Musk's Neuralink, because we've got Synchron, a rival company.
First, didn't they, Synchron?
Yeah. So this is backed by Bill Gates and Jeff Bezos, to name a few. And they are developing a brain computer interface called the Synchron Switch, which is like, this one's more of a stent like device, which is inserted through the patient's blood vessels, and it allows people with limited mobility to operate technology with their minds. So, you know, smart home devices, or, you know, moving a cursor on a computer. So far, it's been implanted in 6 patients in America, 4 in Australia. This is all still very much at the testing phase. You know, it hasn't got the full commercialization legislation through yet. But coming back to like the kind of business side of this, the thing that I thought was really interesting was when this first implant was done by Neuralink in this guy who was playing chess, we suddenly saw the share price of a British semiconductor business more than double in value. So this company called Sondra, which is based in Berkshire, and they make really sophisticated, tiny microchips. So the kind of size that would work well going in a skull. And they make microchips for, they never name the companies they work with, but people are guessing, the rumours are, it's companies like Apple and Tesla. So the big companies. So, and again, already having that link with Musk there with Tesla. It's a company that's listed on the stock exchange in the UK on AIM, the kind of the junior stock exchange. They've had a really interesting time because they had a big drama when they first, not long after they first listed, where they had to announce that they were going to be late paying workers, because one of the companies they worked with, a car manufacturer, an automotive customer, were late paying them. And it wiped, I think, a third off their share price. So they've had this really tough time. But then this rumor came out that they are the semiconductor business that are making these Neuralink chips. And then suddenly the share price doubled in value. But it's all on speculation.
So, Steph, would you ever consider having a chip inserted?
I think I would. You know, I'm not somebody who is scared of technology. I am of the opinion that on the whole, most people are trying to do good and are not trying to destroy the world. So
even Elon Musk.
Yeah, okay, maybe Elon Musk is. But I just think there'll be enough people around that would stop him doing that, surely. But in answer to your question, would I get it? Yes, I would. But would you?
I think it slightly depends on what it's being used for. So we've talked about the manipulation of limbs, prosthetic limbs in particular. And I think in the circumstance where I lost a limb and I had to have a prosthetic limb and I couldn't, for whatever reason, manipulate it. And if somebody said to me, well, if you insert this chip, you know, you'll be able to be mobile again. I think I might well do it. As I understand it, Neuralink and some of these other businesses also believe that in time, these chips may be the solution to degenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and dementia. And that, I suppose, raises all sorts of both practical and ethical problems. So, you know, obviously we all of us, I think, regard dementia and Alzheimer's as an absolutely terrifying prospect. Mm. And on the one hand, if somebody said, if we put a chip in your brain, you will be able to sort of think and remember again. I guess the issue is it actually the artificial intelligence thinking or is it you thinking? I suppose, you know, you'd be worried that in some senses you would not be yourself anymore. You would be this artificial intelligence if it's a thinking chip. In the sense of consciousness, that really tricky issue about what is consciousness, who am I, you know, which is different, I think, from the concept of you that can move your arm or move your leg. The you that is memories and perceptions is different. And so I think it's brilliant that they're researching this area of how these chips might be able to give us back memories and consciousness and reverse dementia, reverse Alzheimer's. But I think I'd remain to be convinced about who is actually, you know, if the chip is inserted, is that still me or is it, you know, a robot?
Yeah, that's the issue. Do you not think though, because I always think you need to look at the past to work out, you know, what might happen with technology in the future. So, you know, you would think that about people with organ transplants, so people who are getting new hearts or whatever it is. There was that moral question then about would I feel differently if I've got somebody else's heart in me? Or even things like IVF. So you're taking the egg out of the body and fertilising it in a lab in a little Petri dish. And that essentially, life's been created in that Petri dish. I think we can just overthink these things too much. And actually, God, I'd love nothing more than if we could solve dementia. I think everyone would. And if that means we might also have to give up some of our mental capacity to Elon Musk, I don't mind. Right.
Don't think Elon minds either, because I mean, I think the point you've hit on here is why there is so much money pouring into this area and why there's so much excitement, because the reality is that the potential, if you get this right, is massive. The commercial potential is absolutely massive. I mean, one of the great diseases as we all live longer, so this is a particular problem in the richer world, is dementia and Alzheimer's, and anything that looks like it's going to help us in those circumstances is potentially worth a fortune.
Yeah, certainly is. And them lot will be making money from it no matter what happens. Right, that's it from us this week. Just a reminder, if you want to send in any questions, because we've got a couple of episodes coming up where we'll be answering them, it is restismoney@gmail.com, or you can send them through our social media sites. Just search The Rest Is Money.
And if you're having a bit of a break over the bank holiday, have a lovely time.
Yeah, enjoy.